Accession number 11324, Reel 2.
Mr. Outerside, Reel 2.
Well, you, as I say, you could not travel without someone watching the sky all the time, because the Stukas was trying to get us all the time. In fact, there was places known as Stukarali and so forth, the names, because they were favourite places where they used to try to catch people out, trucks or whatever it was. Eventually, we got up, and on the process even going to join the battalion, we were once, I would call it, hijacked off the train to go into line, because as infantry troops just formed in as straight as a company, as a mixed group, but we're all in there because we are basically infantry anyway, but to defend the line. Then when we got in there, we found that there was all sorts in there because of the desperation of the situation. Well, as the situation, we're just probably there about a fortnight or so till they got some reinforcements in of the regular people in, and then we moved on our way again, going back to our own people again. This is one of the times when I'm very pleased I was in the guards, because it doesn't matter where you are, you must return you to the guards. Well, I'm at Line Regiment Lance, and they'd about three different regiments had been in.
Because they'd been wounded.
Been wounded, or whatever it is, and just been, like Northumberland Fusiliers, maybe Derbyshire Light, infantry, anybody. They're just who they can choose. But they can't do that with the guards. You're not necessarily going back to a guards regiment, your own regiment, but you will end up in a guards, one of the guards regiments. And then eventually they'll ship you back to your own people. But that was one thing I've always pleased about. I knew I was going to end up eventually back with me pals again. But I've known quite a few men. You've talked to them and said, well, how many different ones that they've been in? The start of the yeomanry or whatever it was, and then they got wounded or something or sick in hospital, and when they came out, they just made them change cap stars or cap badges, whatever it was, and move into another regiment, which I was pleased I didn't have to do.
You said that the military situation for the Allies on that front at that time was very difficult. Why was that so?
Well, I was given to understand we were an army in name, but only two corps in strength. I understand one of the corps was the 10 corps. That's like a 10 on its side, a bar with a ball on the top, 10. Now, I forget the diff sign for the 13 corps, but they were the other one. And we were trying at the time to bottle the Germans in on that section. The same time he was trying to get out, it was a situation. And when we did get to the battalion, we were floating up and down, popping in here and pulling out, and then moving fast at night, and then back in again somewhere else, and so forth. Now, other people were doing the same. You know, I mean, I talked to other men, and they said, well, such as the paratroops, maybe, they're in there and popping up there, trying to kid the Germans how many more we've got. You know, I mean, it's good to say, the core seems up there, and the core seems down there. I think, there must be two lots, you know. But it wasn't. It was the same ones doing the same things. And this happened. When they were on this, I used to be part of the 6th Armoured Division, and my carrier was the CO's carrier, which carried a 19 set, which is the same as a tank set. And it's got an intercom. And what used to happen was my platoon officer used to travel, the CO in convoy, the CO used to travel in the staff car, the big Humber staff car, and my platoon officer would come next to me, and he'd sit down with a cover over his head, torch, and read the map, and I could talk to him. He could put earphones on, and he could talk to me, and we could discuss the landscape, what was come towards it. He said, we should be going now. What can you say? I said, probably a hill on the right, and, you know, there looks to be a valley here. Yeah, that's right, you should be going down now. Yeah, we looked as though we're going, you know, and then talking through the conditions, because you're travelling on roads which is only you think your road is either lighter than the other ground or it's darker than the other ground, but that's the only thing you can really go by. I can't lights forward, but everybody behind me had my diff light. You know, they had my diff light and the other diff light, and everybody was behind was already, because the little, on your differentials, on the backs of your vehicles, you had a number, which was 62, and you had a little light, a little pilot light that shone down, just a little ring light on that. Well, it let the ones following it see who you were. But the one in the front, which was me often, never had anything. It just black road and being told what to expect. You know, there should be a junction here, or there should be something here, there should be a bridge here, whatever it is. He was by his maps, and he's plotting all the route where we are. And sometimes we were miles like this, you know, I mean, trying to do it. Great if we got onto hard standing roads. I mean, it wasn't so bad, but at times, yeah, there was no hard standing roads at all. You just sort of went ploughing on. Many times you drove like this, and times your eyes, with being a carrier, you sense the ground and it's better than you can inside a windscreen. So you're actually travelling without any glasses on or anything, because you have to try to see what you do where you are. And it's just pitch dark. And driving like that, sometimes we're driving along, and to try to put DRs once in front of us to try and help me. And I was following this bobbing red light, and it suddenly disappeared. And I was driving along, and I seen a red light, I swerved towards it. It was a damn signal in the railway line, wasn't it? I was going ahead and for a railway line. You know what I mean? So I said, didn't want them. They shipped them out the road of us because they were distracting me, this red light bobbing up and down, rather than where I was. We were doing better where we were, so they moved them back, which were their normal duties in that case, was just next to the CEO's car. If you had a message to go up and down the convoy, you'd just hand it out the DR and send it up whichever way. So eventually we used to get to the places, and all you'd see was a little tin, these compo tins, 62 on it, and a little lamp in it, and a little arrow telling you which way to go. So nothing else, you just drive along, and at a point, this may be a harbour area for you. You pull into there, just make yourself, and then everybody keeps following you in. And then probably the next morning, the battalion may move into a position, and they may be there 3 or 4 days, or whatever it is. And then they come out again, and we're on the move again. It was hair-raising at times. I can remember, as I said, once over, we were travelling south towards the desert way, and it was a heavy road, and they gave me a relief driver that time, because I'd been doing a lot of that stuff, and the relief driver, but I wasn't leading the convoy this day. And I was up on the top, resting. And I always remember suddenly sort of half dozing sleeping and waking up and seeing a man coming up on a horse leading another one. It was the goons, the French Moroccan troops. And he said, "Oh, okay, Johnny, okay." I startled him. I said, "Okay." I mean, and he just drifted past. And I always thought they were lovely because they used to have big long cloaks that hung down nearly over their feet. And the little short carabines on the back, you know what I mean? Very pleasant chaps. I mean,
but they had a fearsome reputation.
They had, oh yes. The two horses, they always had two horses. The amusing thing was, I always remember giving one a pack of the biscuits. I forget how many was in a packet. And it was about 2 for 1 horse, 2 for the other horse, 1 for his wife, but 2 for himself or something. And that was, he shared them out, because they used to travel, the women used to travel with them, you know, at times. You see them all together, and I thought, well, this is what his priorities are. It was 2 or 3 for the horses each, and he had to give them one, and his wife just got about one, you know. But this was drifting down towards Kesserin and down that way, because it was sandy down that way. And this used to be, as I say, at times through the day, you had to be really observant. I mean, night time I knew you were okay moving, and this is when the movement was done. One of the moves, towards the end of it, the campaign, I can remember, they said they want the carriers. So they took us up this road, and this was interesting. They took us up the road, and we crossed the bridge. And in front of me was a Sherman, going away. He was going up the road. And as I followed up with my brain carrier, I said, right, the Royal Engineers got corrugated sheeting in chains and tied them on the back. And I followed the Sherman, dusting the racket and bottom gear. And the impressions were that I was a Sherman tank as well, like, you know, by the dusting that he was making, I was making. So this happened. And as we got up, and when we got the other end, they were shouting, now, lifting the things up back on the top of the bend carrier, and had a pontoon bridge. And we crossed the river again, the other, very small river, back the other side onto the road. And then we had to go quietly back down again. And then did the same again, you know. So we would keep going round as though there's a whole stream going up this road, this dirt road. Now, but the second the RE said to me, he said, right, and they slung a wood box on the back of the Bren carrier, and two of the men got in it. So as we came, same again, as we came up the top, he turned us off in among the bushes and up in among the hillside. Then they opened up the box, and they got the gas out, and started blowing us up, and it was top of a Sherman tank. You know, compressed air. The nets, the lot. And they start shoving it into position. You know what I mean? This is camouflage. Camouflaged it up. And that night, there we were, going flying down the road. A lot of us, the tanks and tank transport and everything. And they left us, you know. But it was happening. Interesting, as much as we took part in a dummy operation, setting up as though the tanks had been... The tanks was there. And there was tanks among them. But there was... majority was these dummy ones that they set up.
Where was that?
I don't know where exactly the place it was. It was just one of the many places trying to kid them that the Sixth Armoured was in that position at the time. As I say, we were on the way again that night, driving away. But it was interesting as much as... it only happened once. But... it was necessary. I said, whatever the dummy move, trying to kid them on that we're in another place than where we were going.
Where and when did you first come into contact with the German ground troops?
Really, it's not a lot. I never saw many of them. When would it be? I think it would be about getting towards the end when we really come into contact with them. I mean, I came up, as a CO goes on a no group, we would move up close to where he wanted to be to view his ground. Now, normally at the Bren carrier, he's just waving his hand, because there's quite a bit of noise off the engine, but he's just waving his hand a bit, and then he just cut, what signals to cut, stop. Now, where he stops is, I'm watching the ground at the same time that the aerial and stuff's not poking up above the ground levels, and I'm screened where I am from aircraft or whatever it is. Now, he gets out, generally, and walks up, where he may have his intelligence officer with him. Then up comes the company commanders from the different companies, whoever it is, concerned with the O group. They'll come up and I'll point out where the CO is. At the same time, I find out where the companies are when I meet their drivers that's brought them up. Or we're over in that farmer's gym. And where you, you know, where's TAC headquarters, and so forth. And you're finding information from each other where you are. So when they come back to you, and he may say to me, number four company, means I've got to find my way to number four company. He's going to watch them. They're going to probably take the action, whatever it is. So he'd go down and watch them start off, maybe, you know. One of our company commanders, one of our CEOs, used to call him the manager, because he's liable to ask a sergeant, I've seen him ask and say, what are you going to do? What's on your left? What's on your right? Don't know, sir, you know. And then he'd jump the left on it and say, you're just bloody there to tell them, and you're supposed to tell them. And he's really, he says, they don't know, they must know, and he used to really push them. He's very good. It was Colonel Norman. I used to like him from that. They called him the manager because he used to really push them. But he was efficient in his way. But this is what I'll say. You go up to number three company, we'll say, and then you say, back to TAC. Well, we'll go back to TAC, wherever we're going to go. This is normally the procedure of the day. You may go whatever number the company we're going to go with. But you had to be no more than just a driver being told. You had to know to save him trouble. Because, I mean, he's the CEO. He's got enough problems on his mind would you tell me how to drive through where you're going to go. You've got to pick your route and all sorts of things. Because my view was, he's important. He's only one man, but he's got about 1,000 lives in his hands. Where, I mean, you try to save him. I mean, it's funny, but I used to feel this. You had to save him because he has enough worries on his mind without thinking about individual things like that.
Do you remember the places that you went through in Tunisia?
Oh, yes. As I say, the Pishon Pass towards Fondouk, towards Karawan, I should say, towards the Karawan town. As we broke through there, the prisoners was coming in, the German prisoners. That's when we really first start to see them. At the same time, we start to see the 8th Army coming up. They came up at that stage. We met them. And the thing that struck me about them, the camouflage was different. It's desert camouflage against ours, which is a very light sandy mixture of paints rather than ours. Ours is more darker. Plus that, they had things like, in their convoys was nose to tail, and in the middle of it, you got Bofa guns mounted on trucks, and men sitting on them all the time. You know what I mean? They had the aircraft armaments up all the time on convoy work. You know, this is through the day, because the desert people were used to this. Because, I mean, imagine you don't get as much cover stuff, you know, where they can come at you. But they had this, travelling like this all the time, men sitting in them positions. Well, we never had this. You know, I mean, there was little things that you noticed different about them. And this is one of the things I know we noticed quite a bit. Like, you know, as I said, they were completely used to the support of aircraft support, which we had not had up to the latter stages, the aircraft cover, where you could make moves without looking around your shoulder for somebody coming to have a cut your rear end.
They always had a reputation for being a rather flamboyant lot, the 8th Army. Was that true?
Well, I don't think so. I think, I say confidence builds confidence. You know, once you've, if I would say that maybe the flamboyance is what people would say is because once they start pushing them and he's starting to go, I mean, they're feeling on top of the world. The same as ourselves, like when we start to go, we went round the top. We doubled back from Karawan to cut round the top and cut back towards Tunis. At that stage in time, there was two of us, the South African Armoured and our British Six Armoured were on parallel sort of courses for Tunis. And also, some hussars which Monty was supposed to be very favourites of Monty's. And he said they were going to take Tunis. Well, the Sixth Armoured and these sort of people had been sitting there for months, you know, within breathing distance of it. And they resented this very deeply, you know what I mean? That this is, it's funny. I mean, it sounds like battle on us, but it's not that. It's actually, I've been sitting there cracking it. It's going to go to me, sort of thing. So when we actually went to Tunis, I think you'll find my war diary, the Derby Yeo was first into Tunis, but your war records won't tell you that. It'll tell us these hussars and Montes was the ones that went into Tunis, but they weren't.
The Derbyshire Yeomanry
was first in. That was our scout car people to the 6th Armoured, but we turned off. They went in like that and then came back to join us again, you know. But it was just the feelings at the time. It's surprising how feelings become worked up about things like this. And as we're pushing towards cutting off Cap Bon, the Cap Bon Peninsula, this is what we're trying to do, cut that off. And we come to Hammamet. And as I was saying, we actually, a local action taking place on the hills next to Hammamet, where we'd been in action a bit there. And I had the CEO up, and it was Div HQ this time. I was up with him. And that's where we met General Keithley, the Div commander. He used to travel in a Sherman tank when he's up forward with a dummy gun on it. And he used to have a little stepladder, like a little ladder on the side of it. And he was sitting out reading his maps. And he, at that stage, the tank pulled up, and I think it was Brigadier Tanks, I'm not sure, but the tank commander, the officer got out, and he said, "We have problems, sir. The minefield up the beach is holding us up." And Keithley looked at his maps and he said, "The water looks very shallow. Tell them to test the water, because the mines will only go at the edge of the water." And we were watching it from where we were positioned, where we could see, and we had binoculars on, and we saw smoke come down. You couldn't see anything. Then suddenly through the smoke, about six or seven tanks come through, and they're shouting, "Tell you," you could hear it on the loudspeaker on the thing, and they shot up these guns which had been holding us up, the ones in this gorge, I think it was, and they'd been there. And then the push went away again, and we're off again.
That was at Hammamet?
Hammamet.
We've heard a great deal about the setback which the Americans had at the Kasserine Pass.
Yes.
How close to that did you get?
Well, we came round, I think it was one of the first times the Churchill tanks, or about the second time, they were in action, the Churchills. Because they were brought round, and what happened was, one of our infantry went in as infantry support to the tanks. Well, I think basically the Germans had come through the pass and hadn't seen the Churchill tanks, first of all. They were strange to them. This obviously stopped them, because they didn't know what they were, and the tanks were heading towards them, and I think they eventually turned tail and went back, some of them. The ones that, they thought there was a battle, but they turned tail, the other ones, and went back down the pass again. In that stage, some of the, as I said, this tank I found was one of them with its track blown off, and its turret on the side, and I actually took one of the tank's seat covers, the driver's seat cover, which I sent to the Huntington Museum down at the tank museum.
Bovington.
So they've got the tank seat cover from that battle, actually. From when, that was what one of the spillover tanks that had got left. But at that stage, the Yanks was come pouring down the road, and one of the lads told me, he said, the Derby, there was the Sherman tank in the front, and he's driving through them, making them get off the road to let our people get through, to get on the tanks to go in. And he said that the Sherman was up in the front shouting, "Get off the bloody road," he says, "and let somebody fight if you won't." Oh yeah, it was, but they were just panicking and running, I mean, at that stage. And then they pulled off, as I said, they got so far up, but I didn't get up that far. I was, the CEO just said, "Stay here," like, you know, where we were. We watched them go in, you know, from where we were. Watched the tanks take off from there. We didn't see them after that. It was just the artillery and everything, the six armoured was whipping their artillery and everything around to support the tanks as well. I mean, they were really, it was a very close division, the six armoured. They were really, Keithley had done a good job. Whenever they got a chance, he made you work with each other and get to know each other. Not just actually, you looked up and you seen a man across there, and it wasn't just the tanks going past, it was Joe, Bill or Harry. And it meant more to you. And consequently, there was a very close rapport with them, with each other. And later on, we did even more training together. And I always think that was what really built up a very good rapport and comradeship among them.
Why do you think the Americans had this setback at the Kasserine Pass?
Well, I don't know, but it's so green. I mean, there was an item came once in Italy, and I can always remember this. I took the CEO up to one of the hills, and it was near Florence up that way, and we were taken off from the Americans. And it was one of, I forget the name of the hill now, the feature. We were going to take over to relieve them. And the casualties was terrible. They'll come back on mules, you know, dead bodies bringing them back. You know, the mules, a stream of mules going down with dead bodies. And this, I'm assuming this American officer, I don't know, was talking to our CEO. And he said, "Well, what do you got to hold?" He says, "I'm looking at the feature." He says, "Maybe a platoon?" He said, "Maybe a company." He said, "God, fella," he says, "man," he says, What do you think you're going? He said, well, all you need is just one at the side, one at the other side, and one just sitting back from the top. He says, we can cover the face of it with machine gun fire. Nobody get up the front. He says, and if they do, he says, they'll just lob them off the, over the top and roll them down on them. He says, why? What have you been doing? Well, he says, we've been right along the face. He says, God, he says, you just need to keep hitting the face. He's going to hit somebody. And this is where all the casualties. And I always remember this American saying, God, I wish you were in our army telling us what to do. So, I mean, that to me was lack of basic training and some of the tactics, basic tactics.
How far from Florence was that?
That was up near Florence. It was one of the features up near Florence. But that was giving me a little inside picture into that they hadn't had the basic training, at least the officers, the leaders, hadn't been educated in that sense.
Can you tell me about your part in this big push that you mentioned at the Pichon Pass?
Well, we, at that stage, at the Pichon Pass, we actually didn't take, our battalion was reserve at the time. I mean, there was three battalions, and we were often the Grenadiers, Welsh, and ourselves, and one or two was up, and the other one was back. You know, I mean, this is generally the work and the way, and whichever one runs into trouble, the other, the reserve came into it. I mean, that was the system. They started pushing the pass, and we were in a very high ground, and we could see the push taking place. And as the Shermans, the Americans signaled from the right, the Grens, I think it was, had got the feature on the left. I think the Goons had been in the night before, if I remember rightly. And as they started to push forward, there's guns, one or two guns opened up on the right, on the tanks. The tanks started to get hit. So what had happened was the Americans had given the all clear, but they hadn't took the top of the hill. They'd only just gone to the bottom, and so far up the hill he has these guns. Or gun, I don't know which it was now. So the Welsh had to rush in, a fast attack, the Welsh guards, which they did. And they got the feature was taken, and the push went through then, like the Shermans, and it went through. But that was a slip up again. I mean, there was a rhyme, I think, and it used to said, but when Frank Phillips reads the news, the Yanks get all the praise. You know what I mean? It was one of those features. They were the only ones there, supposedly. But we went to Carawan. We found, we scattered, there was one or two tigers bolted out the things because I think the armour was too much for them because a tiger doesn't bolt normally. You know, the tiger tanks don't bolt. We saw one or two disappearing away from us, which pleased us quite a bit in a way. I mean, it would be soft to regard the armour. But as I said, we saw the 8th Army coming up, and they were pushing them up. We went back and cut around and came back into Tunis, and they were cutting across the Cap Bon, and then I think Grombolia was one of the places in the middle of the peninsula part. That was a fascinating thing because I was leading the battalion. I had the platoon officer again. My platoon officer was in next to me, and not the CO at that stage. As we came to it, I can always remember thinking, this is like the 1914 war. All the wires hanging, and bits of wires hanging down, and I think there's a mule.